Chief Justice and members of the panel, good afternoon. May it please the court. Tom Foley on behalf of Mr. Purnell. I am pinch hitting for our departed friend Joe Bernstein and for the newer members of the court. Joe was sort of the academic dean for the criminal defense bar. He was a person we called when we had a question about a legal issue. We're here today because of claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, and there's really sort of a trifecta of problems, each one individually problematic, but in concert, very problematic. The first one is the fact that there was no bland instruction regarding accomplice testimony. And that's sort of as basic as a judge forgetting to tell a jury that the defendant has a right not to testify. This court in November 2013 in a case called Neal v. State, this was after the briefings were done in this particular case. It was also a Joe Bernstein case. But that decision really sort of captures the whole jurisprudence from Bland to Brooks regarding accomplice liability. And, you know, Bland was a 1970 opinion where the court recognized the inherent problems regarding the testimony of an accomplice, which juries should be instructed by a trial court to consider with great suspicion and caution.
Well, we have another one that was just issued. You may not be familiar with it since it's Monday. And that's Hoskins versus State, a Rule 61 appeal.
That came out Monday?
Yes.
I did not know it. Thank you. But in any event,
it's a gift that keeps giving.
Great. My kind of cases.
We might want to have like a kind of huge bland instruction just in all courtrooms just as a prophylactic measure.
I understand. But what happens with the case is we have the Cabrera, Bradley, and Solomon, which all predate this trial. And they say, look, hey, you got to give an accomplice instruction. We're not going to tell you what it is, but you got to at least tell the jury something about accomplice testimony. Then we get to Smith v. State, where this court says that it's automatic first-prong error in an ineffective assistance claim if it's not there. And then we wind up with Brooks saying that it's plain error. One of the things that was reiterated in Smith is the court says that the general witness credibility instruction is not good enough to cover accomplice testimony. And the trial court, in denying Mr. Purnell's Rule 61, said, oh, yeah, it is good enough. So that's the problem. And I think
let's assume for the sake of this question for me that, you know, you're past the first prong of Strickland, and that the law is as established as you say it is, and there's no tactical value to not asking for that. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, right? It's sure. Actually perfectly consistent with the strategy of casting doubt on these people's credibility. So there's no real reason, I believe, they fessed up and said, I don't know why I didn't do it. Isn't the question, though, that we have to think about and where you have to get us there is Strickland's not that easy to tell. You have to show that there's a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different had the bland instruction been given, right? And so we have to isolate essentially the additive weight of a bland instruction, put that on the scale, and see whether there's a meaningful chance. Doesn't have to be more probable than not, but some, you know, meaningful chance that the jury would have concluded differently than they did, right?
Actually, it's not that demanding. That's more harmless error. The Strickland test is really that not that the outcome would be different, but that it undermines reliability, undermines confidence.
Well, see, I don't really understand why anybody would want harmless error. I mean, I don't understand. Strickland, I don't understand it to be harmless. Strickland is that there's prejudice, right? If there's a reasonable probability the outcome would have been different, right? If there hadn't been the...
If it undermines confidence in the verdict, reliability.
Yes.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
And that's where the focus is in this case. And that's the difference between Neal, because in the Neal case, the court gets to prejudice, but in the Neal case, you had overwhelming evidence where you had 85 exhibits, 24 witnesses, The fruits of the robbery and the disguise were found in the car next to Neal. In this case, you have very weak facts. The state can't say, hey, there's no prejudice here in a case where they flipped the co-defendant after jury selection. That right there is a telltale sign of the prejudice in this case. It was a weak, weak case. There was no forensic or physical evidence linking Purnell to the crime scene. The two witnesses, Mr. Giles, the husband, were shown Purnell's photo, never identified him. The other gal, Miss Rain, the one smoking crack, she's shown the photo. She does not ID him. So the state's case is a guy named Corey Hammond, who's arrested a year after this homicide on drug charges. He's got two pending drug charges. He gets arrested for trafficking. He's got a baby due coming within the week. And the cop says, you're in a lot of trouble. And Hammond says, hey, great. Hey, this guy named Purnell told me about a robbery.
But the thing is, the jury knew all that because your client's trial counsel brought that home to them, right?
Correct.
And there was independent evidence corroborating some of the testimony, and the judge didn't give a Bland instruction but did caution the jury to focus on the motives that were influencing witnesses, right, and the possible biases or prejudices of witnesses?
That was a general witness instruction.
I understand it.
And this
right.
court said that's not good enough. It's different. And the Supreme Court said that's not good enough.
Right, which is why the rule is that you have to give this. But now we're at a point where you're trying to win a Strickland case.
Correct.
And therefore, the question becomes whether you can show prejudice, which means at least to get to help your client, you got to help me by focusing on that specific thing, which is how do we get to had the judge gone from the instruction that was given in the context of what we've been talking about, which is a vigorous cross-examination. You admit the trial counsel vigorously cross-examined about all these issues, right?
Correct.
Cast doubt on the testimony for all the reasons you're talking about. Judge gives a general thing that focuses on motive but doesn't give the specific Bland instruction. What I'm asking you is to tell me at least, so I understand it, how that additive value of the specific Bland thing would create a reasonable probability of a different outcome.
Because it's not the trial lawyer's job to instruct the jury. It's the referee, it's the umpire. And it's a lot different when it comes out of the trial judge's mouth to the jury saying, hey folks, let me tell you about accomplice testimony. It's not for the defense lawyer to have that burden to simply say, oh, I cross-examined him pretty well, and I brought up all these shortcomings in the state's other witnesses.
The witness, Harris, at one point told the police that your client had nothing to do with the murder.
Twice. And one was a 13-hour interview.
Now, is that testimony to be viewed with suspicion and great caution?
Yes. Yes.
Even if it favors your...
No, you mean the prior statement.
Well, that's what I...
No, the instruction goes to testimony, not prior statements.
Well, did it come out during trial through his testimony that he said that?
It came out through cross-examination.
Is that testimony to be viewed with suspicion and great caution?
That's not testimony. It's a prior statement.
But that's, well, he testifies
where,
about
that's
it.
That's impeachment material, Justice. The testimony is what he says in the courtroom. There was never an instruction about the testimony. The defense lawyer was impeaching the testimony with prior inconsistent statements. That's different. This is an instruction about testimony, not about what's said in a police station during other interviews.
I guess what I'm getting at is the trial court's ruling that there's a good tactic here because you want that part of his testimony, whether it's impeaching or otherwise, to be believed by the jury, so that there is a tactical reason for not asking for a Bland instruction.
There's never a tactical reason for...
Well, what if there could be when you want some of the testimony believed by the jury?
You want the prior statements to trump the testimony. That's cross-examination. But again, I think that the question you're asking is, did the defense lawyer get the point out that Harris was...
All right, let me give an easier hypothetical. Let's assume that Harris gets called by the defense. And during direct, he gives what he told the police. Your client had nothing to do with it. and, you know, he's innocent, da-da-da-da-da. On cross-examination, he turns around and says, well, actually, he was involved. Does the defense request a bland instruction in that scenario?
I think the accomplice instruction goes to when he's a state's witness. And if the defense calls him as a defense witness and he goes south on cross, then tough luck.
Okay, so have we held that before, that Bland is limited to state's witnesses?
I think the context is always that was the fact pattern. I have not ever seen a case on the scenario that you posed. But
it's Perry Mason-like, sort of in the reverse.
Right. You got a bigger problem if that happens. But I really think that it's a fundamental flaw when the jury does not get instruction from the referee's mouth, saying, you got to really watch this. It's not the defense lawyer's job to simply just impeach the guy and show inconsistent statements and so on and so forth. In this case, you know, there really wasn't great independent evidence. All the evidence has huge holes. The witnesses were on deals. Kelly Mitchell was a person who was actually fingered by by Mr. Giles as one of the perpetrators. No physical evidence. And again, the fact that the state is flipping the co-defendant after jury selection, that tells you how strong of a case it was. It was a terrible case. That's why they were flipping.
There are several other witnesses, right?
There were several, but they weren't. I'll go through them very quickly. I mean, you have the.
Well, you got a tape recording, right?
You have a tape recorded phone call, but as I read the closing argument, there were some context issues. There wasn't anything really that, primarily a 16 or 17 year old kid. And I think when you look at the context of that phone call, it wasn't clear exactly what he was talking about.
Had a lot to do with the murder. You got Etienne Williams, Kelly Mitchell's girlfriend. Now she says it might have been joking.
She testified. She said it wasn't. She goes, not might. She said we thought he was joking.
She believed he might have been joking. You have Kelly Mitchell himself. I know you say he didn't recall a trial, but I believe the state introduced some evidence about your client.
3507 statement that he made. But again, Kelly Mitchell is the one who was pulled out of hell by a SWAT team. He knew they were looking at him. And
you're obviously not a fan of the Corey Hammond testimony, right?
Not at all.
And
no forensics.
What about Akeisha Williams?
She was on the same three-way with her sister when they had some guy call my guy in an Excel phone, call Purnell, and that's where they had this conversation where he apparently, says, I killed him, but they're laughing, they're joking. Both witnesses in court said, do you think he was joking? Yeah, because he was using the word psych. He's a 16, 17-year-old kid at the time of the conversation. Mm-hmm. This is not the kind of, again, it goes to reliability. We don't have DNA. We don't have a tape confession. We don't have the kind of things we can really say is independent. The state's case had witnesses.
It's interesting. Is psych now, see, when thing when I had bangs in the 70s, that was the thing kids said. And now it's the spelling has changed, huh?
Yeah, it took me a while to process that when I was reading
it. It used to be P-S-Y-C-H.
In old school.
Right, and this is the new, okay.
This is it.
The new spelling.
Now,
this is the new fat. It's P-H-A-T.
And going back to the original question as we talk about prejudice, as you look at the trifecta here, and let me move on to these other issues because these are problematic, there's no cautionary instruction given to the jury about the guilty plea. And the reason you would give a cautionary instruction is you'd say, hey, this is why. Here's why the guilty plea came in, and number two, you can't use Harris's guilty plea against Purnell's evidence of guilt. And that didn't happen here. And then the other side of that...
Yeah, that's where I really lost the thread of the briefs you were writing on that. Because other cases were situations where the state was trying to put the guilty plea before somebody and use it in the... Here, you know, your client's counsel was actually saying, I want that jury to know this guy pled guilty. He got a freaking deal. That's why he's saying what he's saying. He's not telling the truth. This goes hand in hand. I understand why you would like the additive value of the judge saying, and listen to counsel on top of that, because that's an accomplice, right? And because it would reinforce that message, but it's very difficult to get that before the jury without the jury understanding that the guy pled guilty. Right, you can't get before the jury your own argument about why you should be skeptical about the person's testimony because he has a personal reason to give it at the expense of the colleague, right, without the jury knowing.
Well, the issue was that the guilty plea came in, Chief Justice, because the prosecutor's opening statement said the guy just pled guilty. Okay, so it's in there. So the issue is not the guilty plea coming in. The issue is a cautionary instruction about how you handle the evidence against Purnell. And that's a problem. So it's not the fact that the guilty plea comes to evidence, it's the lack of a cautionary instruction. And the other side of that coin is the failure to appeal the fact that you have the same jury who, during jury selection, they see two guys at the table, they come off opening statements, and there's one guy at the table.
Well, what's the law on that? Because I read your briefs, and I couldn't find any law.
Because I think it's a pretty basic thing that happens, you impanel the jury. Here's part of the problem.
Could you cite the case then it was basic? Because I couldn't find the basic rule that when that happens, you have to have a new jury.
Well, make it more fundamental. The state got 6 peremptory strikes. Purnell got 3. Because the other 3 strikes were Harris's. So the guy testifying against them got 3 strikes for this jury. So how is that not problematic? And that's what you raise an appeal. The state gets 6 strikes. The defense got 6 total. So Harris got to exercise 3 strikes on the jury panel that he then went and testified in front of.
But at the time, that was proper procedure, wasn't it?
It's proper procedure to split it. But when the guy pleads, then you simply say, hey, we're going to go get a new jury. I mean, they couldn't take another hour to pick a new jury.
I guess what I'm asking, and I think we're going to just like, I hunger at times. I hunger as a matter of professional responsibility. I don't want to overstate my personal hunger for it. I hunger as a matter of professional responsibility for law. When I read this aspect of it, it was like taking that it's some automatic thing that you always get a new jury when one defendant who's going to trial out of 2 or 3 pleads guilty. It strikes me not an unprecedented situation, and your brief cites nothing.
Well, what the brief cites, it cites the Allen case, but what Mr. Bernstein is writing is he's saying, look, it's mistake number one not to impanel new jury, but at a minimum, you better give a cautionary instruction about the guilty plea that just took place. You have a double whammy here. 2 errors for one thing.
Do you have a case on the first error?
Allen.
That's where you got to get a new jury?
No, that's where you get the caution.
I'm asking about the whole thing.
No, I don't have a case as I sit here.
Okay.
No. I see that my time on direct is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, good afternoon. Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. The Bland type instruction, the credibility instruction, this court, as you know, has repeatedly in recent years addressed this issue. And although the court has indicated that there's unlikely to be a tactical reason to not ask for a Bland instruction, if there is a case, this is it. Because for the very reason that the co-defendant here did make statements that defense wanted to use and did not want him to be entirely unbelievable. In fact,
well, Mr. Foley says that wasn't testimony.
I understand that. But here, if you gave the Bland instruction, it would highlight the Mr. Harris's testimony as being less credible than any of the other people who were testifying, which is another reason why you might not want to give one that focused on him. There were plenty of other people who had credibility issues that were similarly situated.
But a lawyer could easily argue that this instruction is referring to the incriminating testimony the witness gave in court, obviously not to the exonerating statement outside of court, correct?
That is true. That is true. But it would once again highlight that testimony over the other testimony. And here, too, defense
but
used...
But can we make up a reason that makes sense for counsel when counsel can't you know, it's nice for the state to come forward and say, oh, this was a tactical thing. When the trial says, candidly, I can't recall why I didn't request the instruction. And I don't really understand. It seems to me Bland is perfect. Getting a Bland instruction is particularly useful in a situation where, you know, somebody has pled guilty. And frankly, it's helpful to have a Bland instruction if they've changed their story. Because what you're actually saying to them is, like, be suspicious. This person has a reason to tell you something right now that is not fully the truth because of their self-interest, and be suspicious of it. And we've got that. We know what it is. That person got a deal that is got a deal, and that's why he's sitting there up here testifying.
Correct.
It's not like you're trying to actually portray the person, oh, I'm in a predicament. If I prove that he's telling a lie now, then I compromise everything he ever said. What you say before is, frankly, look at the story before he got the deal. When it's not affected by the fact that he's getting something in exchange for his promise to testify. So I'm not understanding how a trial counsel would ever forego this.
It's a possibility that the
Do we deal with possibilities on the first prong of Strickland?
Well, the state was willing to say definitely that there would never be a tactical reason. And here, and I do think that the highlighting of that testimony, when in fact it was other testimony where people had deals, that was probably stronger in some ways because they couldn't make it as blatant, the difference between prior statements and the late, very late change of story in terms of the accomplice. As my colleague pointed out, you had Corey Hammond, who had a very strong motive with a deal. You had Kelly Mitchell, who suddenly forgot things at trial. He had a reason too. People had motives in this case. This is one of those cases where there were a lot of not ideal witnesses from the state's point of view, or from the defense point of view, and it was difficult because everyone had a motive and they were interrelated. So to highlight one over another may have been a possible tactical reason to do that. In any case, the state believes that there's no prejudice under Strickland. This is not a case where there was not independent corroborating evidence. There was a lot of corroborating evidence from these very witnesses who did have other motives and other deals, yet they produced evidence.
Do you agree there's no forensic evidence, as Mr. Foley said?
Well, forensic in the sense of ballistics and things like that, correct. There is the taped phone call from the prison phone call, which was played at the trial where Tremaine Mitchell had called and John Purnell was also on the line, and they were discussing, the defendant was telling Tremaine that, hey, your brother's been locked up on this murder. And Tremaine's like, what do you mean my brother's being locked up on this murder? And Purnell says he didn't do it. And then there was a discussion about, well, why were they picking you up? And what were they doing there, talking about the police? And Purnell says, well, I got a lot to do with it. Or when he's asked, well, what do you have to do with it? And he said, a lot. And that is, in a sense, independent of all these different witnesses, that was a tape recorded phone call out of the mouth of the defendant saying he had a lot to do with it. So there is that. There's also the testimony of various people about the white bags, confirming that they had seen the scene, that they were familiar with the scene. There's also the bedpost graffiti that the defendant had scribbled, calling Kelly Mitchell a snitch. And that was produced at trial as well, with a handwriting expert who matched that to other writings. There was the discovery of the letter where the defendant had a copy of the warrant that had clearly come from the state because there was redacted names of witnesses and a police report warrant. And the handwriting expert matched that handwritten notes on this in an envelope from the defendant, and those handwritten notes put in the names of the two witnesses, the two Williams sisters, in the section about the phone call that he had had with Tukey. also known as Jerome Porter. So there was that evidence that he knew that they were there at that time and he had made the phone call, because otherwise how would he know the names of the witnesses? So there's other evidence that did come out at trial, and there was...
What your learned friend says is, but this case does still, there are a lot of people saying a lot of things. The defendant himself says some things, but it ultimately gets down to what does the jury believe and who was the shooter that day, that a lot of the defense is based on compromising a key, you know, the person you actually, the state charged and was sitting at defense table at the beginning of trial, based on that person's testimony, and that the additive value of the judge with the independent credibility of the judge telling the jury, you need to listen especially closely to this testimony and to consider this with, you know, particular care and have specific confidence, that was very important in this case and that wasn't done. And that in a case like this, this is exactly where you can't say that there's no prejudice.
Well, in this case, the prosecutor in closing even addressed that issue and conceded that if all we had was Mr. Harris's statement, we wouldn't be here. Here's all the corroboration that we have, and addressed that point directly, that there was corroborating evidence. Defense counsel was very active in cross-examination and brought out all the motives of all these witnesses. And in addition to that, frankly, the defense case itself fell apart. And the defense alibi witnesses actually contradicted each other and created a real problem for the defense in terms of convincing this jury of the client's innocence or a reason to acquit, when the family members came in, well, the grandmother came in and completely contradicted evidence that she had said that the defendant was with her, never left the apartment. LaToya Moody said he was in her apartment 10 out of those 14 days. That grandmother said he never even left the apartment. He was actually intaked at the Newcastle County Detention Center during the time frame that grandmother said he wasn't there. There was a witness brought in rebuttal to show that. So the defense attempt to, you know, an alibi is great if you prove it. When you don't, the jury is apt to react to that. So in this case, given the strenuous efforts by trial counsel, the prosecution's acknowledgement that, hey, we're not going to take this guy's word, here's everything that corroborates it, and the collapse of the alibi defense. If you put all of that together, there's no doubt in this trial that there's no Strickland prejudice.
How about the failure to ask for either a new jury to be impaneled or to ask for an instruction about the guilty plea?
Well, the state looked for a case that would say that was automatic and did not find one, and the cases were not on point that were out there. And there was no way that a new jury wasn't going to learn that the plea came at the last minute. That was important for the defense to bring out in terms of strategy of, hey, this guy made these other statements, and it wasn't until he was getting three years instead of life, you know, yesterday, that he changed his tune.
What would the cautionary instruction that appellate counsel argues should have been given, what would it have actually said under Allen?
Well, it's a limiting instruction that Allen is not exactly on point either, because there was a non-testifying accomplice there, and here you had a testifying. But the idea is that should come in, the plea agreement itself should only come into evidence to address credibility issues, not as substantive evidence. Here, defense counsel actually used and read from the plea agreement, and it was certainly being used for that very purpose. And I don't think there was any danger here. That certainly, the state would agree, is an error. There should be a limiting instruction, but it is not fatal in this case.
What should have been a limiting instruction because the defense was using it improperly?
No, no, simply because that's what you do with evidence that is, doesn't come in as substantive evidence, that evidence that comes in solely for the purpose of the credibility should be limited to that.
Well,
for the jury to understand the use of it.
How do you address the cumulative effect of these two errors in concert? If you assume that they were each a Strickland violation, did they cumulatively amount to more prejudice?
In this case, no. As I said, in this case, the reason I was saying that was because defense counsel was using the plea agreement himself. He was reading from it. In fact, it was really important to the defense to focus on that agreement to discredit Mr. Harris's testimony.
So the absence of a limiting instruction is what? Not prejudicial on the facts of this case? Harmless error? What is it?
Well, since it's been raised under a Strickland claim in post-conviction, it would be no prejudice under Strickland for trial counsel's failure to have requested a limiting instruction.
As a per se rule or on the facts of this case?
On the facts of this case. I mean,
what you're saying on this one, unlike the one where the guy can't remember, what you're saying is if anyone in the trial used this as a cudgel offensively, it was the defense itself, and therefore it didn't make any sense to ask for this limiting instruction when the defense was actually using the evidence offensively, and that Allen was a case where really it was the state that was trying to use the guilty plea offensively to make out its case. That isn't really the situation here.
That's correct.
Didn't Mr. Foley say, though, that the prosecutor referred to the guilty plea in his opening and closing arguments? In what way was the state seeking to use the...
To explain why Mr. Harris was testifying.
Okay.
And the conditions under which he was testifying.
So it's more inoculatory to just say the full facts about the circumstances in which he was appearing.
Correct. And in fact, in opening, the prosecutor pointed out that there were various witnesses who were there because they had deals or had prior histories, criminal histories. He was trying to prepare the jury for a list of witnesses that were not like their next-door neighbors, potentially. In this case, although there's no forensic, there's no bullets, there's no gun, there's nothing like that. There is clearly a good amount of independent corroboration of Mr. Harris's testimony, which was, in fact, quite short. And even to the extent that his testimony said that the defendant, that the victim had turned and started walking away, and that was confirmed by the medical examiner by noting that the victim was shot in the back. So and was actually found down in the initial reports of someone lying in the street with a chest wound, so that would not necessarily have been something he would have picked up elsewhere. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The state keeps falling back on the notion that the defense lawyer covered any problems. And I don't know how we can have this court say in Brooks that it's plain error not to give an accomplice instruction, and for the state to simply say it's still no biggie, not a problem. Defense lawyer handled it. And
well, that the Brooks isn't retroactive, is it?
It's not, but we've gone that far where it's plain error. But I'll read from a 1909 U.S. Supreme Court case, Crawford v. United States. When an alleged accomplice testifies, his confession ought to be received with the very greatest care and caution and ought not be passed upon the jury under the same rules governing other witnesses. This was cited in the Lilly v. Virginia case, which was the first kind of confrontation case regarding hearsay. So this is not like the new thing. This is a very, very basic premise. And for me, it's the same as a judge not telling a jury about defendant right not to testify. You just don't leave that out. It's got to come out of the judge's mouth. And when you look at this case, the state very conveniently sort of says, oh, we have all this other great stuff. But when you actually read the trial transcript in this case, that stuff was diluted quite a bit. It really was not strong. There really is not a lot of independent evidence in this case. Very, very weak, I would say. And you have to sort of examine it. So that it all comes down to reliability in the verdict. You have a kid who was 17 years old or 16 years old doing a 45-year sentence. And when the court has to ask itself whether not impaneling a new jury, not giving instructions about the guy's guilty plea, and not giving an accomplice
pause
instruction.
Pause on that one. What would the instruction about the guilty plea have been said? What would it have said in your view?
It would have been twofold. It would have said, here's why the guilty plea was before you, ladies and gentlemen. And two, you cannot use that guilty plea as evidence of guilt toward Purnell. And it's got to come out of the judgment. And the jury just saw this, all this happen, and the court didn't give them any guidance, any direction on what just happened in front of their own eyes.
What was the risk that the guilty plea by Harris would have been used against Purnell, given the strategy of counsel to actually affirmatively use the guilty plea to compromise Harris's credibility?
He had to. He was stuck with it. He couldn't roll over and play dead. He's got to address it. It's coming in, Justice. That's not the issue. It's the instruction of how a jury should process it. And that's what they were not
given.
Yeah,
I understand. Especially the case Allen itself, as I recall, that's a case where really only the state is bringing something in, right? Here, defense counsel wanted to have that guilty plea front and center before the jury, right?
Well, the state beat him to the punch, but yes, you're right. Of course
right.
He would. Of course he would. He would say, they just bought your testimony an hour ago. That's what he argued.
And I'm trying to say, why would you think that the jury would say, Harris pled guilty, therefore this guy must be guilty?
Because it's the optics of two guys at the table, and they're thinking, okay, this guy got the message, the gig's up, here comes the jury, he went and pled guilty, so Purnell's guilty. It's a different when it happens right in front of you versus a co-defendant who pled, you know, a month or two ago. And they never see him at the defense table. It's the optics.
It's that the jury's perceiving. Oh shucks, they're looking at these, and the first one who says oh shucks and gets the message gets the better deal. But
they're both guilty.
Both of them are guilty.
They're both guilty, and you just it's like the defendant being brought in the courtroom in front of the jury with chains, and the correctional officer beating him because he's getting smart with them or something. It's that kind of bad thing. You have to address it. You just can't let it go, and then say defense lawyer handled it. It's just below the standards of a fair trial in Delaware or anywhere else.
And the case that says that is
Allen. This court said it right now and said whenever it comes in, you have to give a cautionary instruction. It's required.
And it's not distinguishable because that was a non-testifying.
No, in the opinion in Allen, the court said no matter when it comes in, no matter what the circumstances, you have to give a cautionary instruction. This court did not restrict it to the scenario where it's a non-testifying co-defendant. It says whenever it comes in, you have to have a cautionary instruction. And that's what, if you look at what all the courts do around the country.
Does it matter, and I know we're in the red, and I apologize to my colleagues for asking this, but it follows up on Justice Ridgely's question. If the reason the state used it in first was because they knew your client's counsel was going to use it forever. Throughout the entire thing, is that a distinguishing factor from Allen?
No.
So, if the state hadn't used it at all, you'd still have to give the instruction?
Absolutely.
Even if the defendant was the only one who introduced the please.
Absolutely. The referee has to give some guidance to the judge of, you know, this is why this came in. It was for witness credibility issues or whatever the purpose is. And, hey, you can't use it against Purnell. You got to tell him that.
Thank you, counsel,
Thank
for your
you.
Patience. And we will take the matter under advisement.